and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the massive forest fires in Alberta that have become the costliest natural disaster in Canada's history, and speak with Dr. Mike Flanagan, a professor with the Department of Renewable Resources and the director of the Western Partnership for Wildland Fire Science at the University of Alberta. He joins us to discuss the forest fire that began on May the 1st as part of the cycle of nature, and that only when man-made structures are placed in the forests do you end up with the kind of damage in Fort McMurray, where 88,000 people were evacuated and one-fifth of the homes were destroyed at an estimated loss of $7 billion. Then we'll look into the escalating legal battle between the governor of North Carolina and the United States Attorney General, who today accused the state of North Carolina of, quote, state-sponsored discrimination against transgender individuals. Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, Emeritus Professor of Medicine at the University of North Carolina's Center for Infectious Diseases, joins us to discuss the cynical nature of the bathroom law being used by Republican lawmakers to rile up their religious right base for the upcoming elections, and that little attention has been paid to the rest of the laws that were slipped through in a special session, such as banning any raise in the minimum wage. Then finally, we will speak with Richard Winger, publisher and editor of Ballot Access News, about the efforts underway by dissident factions in the Republican establishment who are frantically searching for a candidate to run as a conservative alternative to Donald Trump, now the party's presumptive standard bearer. We will discuss the various ballot deadlines for independent candidates entering the presidential race, most of which indicate there is still time to get an independent third-party alternative to Trump on the ballot, and that already the Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson is getting much more attention than usual due to Trump. And joining us now from Alberta, Canada, is Dr. Mike Flanagan, who is a professor with the Department of Renewable Resources and the director of the Western Partnership for Wildland Fire Science at the University of Alberta. He worked as a meteorologist for a few years, then as a physical scientist, research scientist, and senior research scientist with the Canadian Forest Service. Dr. Flanagan's primary research interests include fire and weather-climate interactions, including the potential impact of climate change, lightning-ignited forest fires, landscape fire modeling, and interactions between vegetation, fire, and weather. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Mike Flanagan.
Oh, my pleasure.
And clearly this blaze that started on the 1st of May has become quite a monster. It's caused the evacuation of 88,000 people from Fort McMurray, where one-fifth of the houses have been burned, and the estimates of insurance claims are about 9 billion Canadian, 7 billion US. But my understanding is that there have been previous fires in the boreal forests that has essentially burned on for months until the snows come. So how unusual is this fire? Is it largely getting the attention it's getting because it has hit a major city?
Yes. I think that if this fire had been 200 kilometers to the east in the middle of the boreal forest with no values around, it's still a large fire that would generate a lot of smoke, but it would not be the news story it is, because it has caused the evacuation of 80,000 plus people and the estimated insurable losses, which are just guesses at this point, but they're significant, and it will be the most costliest natural disaster in Canadian history.
But that said, does it therefore mean that with these large fires that essentially have to burn themselves out sometimes over months, is there much that you can do? I know they've employed an enormous amount of assets to deal with it, but at the end of the day, what are the firemen doing and what can they do?
Okay, large fires are a common feature in the Canadian forests and in Western United States. In Canada, 3% of the fires burn, 97% of the area burned. Western United States, 1% of the fire burned, 99% of the area burned. So it's a relatively small number of fires that do all the impact damage, if you call it damage. All the area burned are a result of a few fires. Yes, some of these large fires in Canada can burn for months through the fire season, and even in deeper organic layers called peat bogs, they can continue to burn and smolder all winter long and arrive the following spring. So that's the context. There's three things that drive the fire on the landscape in Canada and Western United States and Alaska, and that is the fuel, how much you have, what type it is, how dry it is, are all important. Ignition, people, and lightning are the two common ones. And third is the weather, hot, dry, windy weather. So we have lots of communities in our forests in Canada, and all these communities are vulnerable or at risk. And Fort McMurray just happened to be, the city that was hit by this fire at this time. But what we're seeing is, and, there's a couple reasons behind this this disaster, this devastating impact. One is more now than ever, people are living, working, and playing in the forest. So that's kind of increasing the exposure because there's more of us in the forest. Second, the weather is getting more conducive, more extreme fire weather is occurring so that we seem to be setting up for more fire. And so you've got this intersection between fire, which is a common, factor of living in the boreal, and people that are, now a lot more of them than there used to be. And then you get the result that we see this past week in northern Alberta, this devastating fire.
And Mike Flanagan, my understanding is that even though there's a, I think one of the Canadian ministers said that they've turned the corner on this fire, it still could take months before it's fully brought under control. Is that your understanding?
It's possible. The three ingredients, once the fire starts, you've got the fuel and the weather, and the fire will continue to spread as long as fuel's available and the weather's appropriate. Now, we could get some heavy rains. We have something in this part of the world called June monsoons, and they often come with an inch or two of rain. So that could assist. It's a huge fire. It's vast. And it will take some time for firefighters to contain it. But if they get some cool, showery weather for a couple of weeks, they could have enough time to contain it. But in terms of impact on the community and values, it's pretty well past Fort McMurray and the built-up areas, and now is kind of in true boreal. There's another highway in the Saskatchewan side, which is our neighboring province to the east, that it could impact, but there's very few values now, so it's just burning the forest. And our forest is used to fire. It survives and thrives instead replacing high-intensity fires. So the forest is used to this. It'll regenerate. It's kind of the cycle of life. You have forest, fire comes, you get new forest. And so that shall carry on.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Mike Flanagan, who's a professor with the Department of Renewable Resources and the director of the Western Partnership for Wildland Fire Science at the University of Alberta. So that said, Dr. Flanagan, then, what about wildlife? Do they adapt? Do they escape?
Well, some escape. I mean, birds can fly. Others can run. Some of them will not survive the fire. Sometimes I think there's this misconception that when a fire goes through, everything burns. But there's often unburnt islands, and sometimes they're wetlands, and sometimes they're physical islands on lakes. There's a fair number of lakes in this landscape. So there are places where there can be refugia where animals can move to, but there are things that do die in the fire, and this is just part of Mother Nature's cycle of life. But many things, animals are not stupid. Okay, if they smell smoke and see flames, they move away as quickly as they can, and so there's usually lots of survivors. And then after the fire's gone through, you start getting beetles, and it's kind of like different species populate the area. Often there's beetles come in and start chewing up some of the dead material, and different kind of pioneer species like fireweed comes in, and blueberries and morels, and So there's kind of a whole cycle that goes through in the ecology of the boreal forest, but it's Mother Nature at work, and it's used to this kind of high-intensity large fire.
But Mother Nature could be accused of starting these fires, even though, as you say, that it's all a part of the cycle of life. But more often than not, they're man-made causes. I don't think anybody knows the cause of this one. But also, certainly Mother Nature is not, you know, scooping up the oil sands and in these vast operations. So when you say the peat catches on fire, I understand that they dodged a major bullet with the tar sands facilities, but at any point, were they in danger of igniting?
So first, let's talk about peat. Okay, peat is organic material that's 40 centimeters or more in depth, and a lot of the peat bogs we have are sphagnum mosses, and they can burn and do burn, and they can burn a long time. The oil sands or bitumen processing or tar sands, whatever you want to call it, this is starting to get an area outside my expertise, but I don't think there's much of an issue with them catching fire. There's a lot of cleared area of no vegetation, but I'm not sure about how flammable the bitumen is directly. If a burning ember fell on it, is it easily ignited? I do not know.
But the bottom line is it didn't happen, right? There was a concern of some of the big storage tanks could catch on fire, but the fire seems to have avoided the worst of it, right?
Right. It did not happen. I mean, there's been some shutdowns, but that's because the workers were evacuated or because of the smoke made it unhealthy for workers to do their jobs. So there has been shutdowns in production because of this fire. But now the fire is pretty well to the east. There's still some smoke and hot spots around, but the major activity is almost in Saskatchewan now. So,
but in general, you know, with all of this 500 firefighters and all of this massive evacuation of 88,000 people, my understanding is that there actually been no deaths except from a car accident during the evacuation. Is that your understanding?
That is, as far as I know, correct.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of amazing and fortunate that there was not greater loss of life. You know, the evacuation occurred, and it was kind of shocking to evacuate a city of this size and that to go that smoothly, because we don't have to look very far in the past to see really tragic loss of life in Australia, Black Saturday fires, 2009, Greece in 2007. And, in terms of significant numbers, Australia was, just under 200 people lost their lives in the Black Saturday fires. Now, this fire was really intense. It generated a thunderstorm, which we call a pyrocumulonimbus, and it generated lightning. And from this lightning, it started new fires, which is I'm familiar with pyrocumulonimbus, pyro-CBs, and occasionally some of these do have lightning activity associated with, but this is the first time that I've seen that the lightning started new fires, so it's kind of self-perpetuating itself.
And in terms of the Canadian government's response, there were offers from many countries around the world for help. Prime Minister Trudeau said that the Canadians can handle it on their own. Each state is in charge of its own firefighting assets, and it seems that they were able to bring enough to bear. Is that what happened?
I think that's fair. I mean, we do have, there's an interagency agreement between provinces where we get resources, and there's resources from Ontario here, because no one province can go alone. And we do bring in resources from the United States and at times New Zealand and Australia and even South Africa. Their fire season in the Southern Hemisphere is kind of the opposite of ours, so usually their resources are available. The United States is much closer, so we often get firefighters from Montana and Washington, Idaho, and we often send firefighters down to Western United States when things get bad there, usually later in the summer. So there's this sharing agreement and it works very well. The trick is to put your order in soon enough so you can get the resources there when you need them, because it does take time to travel, you know, sometimes thousands of kilometers to get to where the fire is.
But in this case, it wasn't necessary. So I guess just to wrap up then, the worst is over, Dr. Mike Flanagan?
Well, in terms of impact on the community, yes, the worst is over. It's done. I'm not sure if we have an accurate number on how many structures are lost. We've heard 1,600, 2,000, and I'm sure the estimate for insurable losses is going to change from that early estimate. It might go down, it might go up, I'm not sure, but it'll be very significant, multiple billions of dollars.
But just in closing, the climate change aspect of it, since you have studied weather climate interactions and the potential impact of climate change, how much can you make the connection with this particular fire?
Well, I don't like to say any individual event is a result of climate change. It's consistent with what we believe is happening with climate change, but to say this particular fire is a direct result is, I can't say that. What I can say is that area burned in Canada and in Alaska and Western United States has been increasing. Canada, we've doubled in the last 40 plus years, and we believe that's due to human caused climate change. So we believe climate change is increasing the frequency of large fires, the intensity of large fires, and this is just what we expect in the future, more of this. And there's lots of communities in the boreal that are at risk, and as long as there's this continued growth of population in our boreal forest, and as long as we expect the fire weather to be severe and getting severer, there's going to be this type of interaction.
Well, Mike Flanagan, I thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Mike Flanagan, who's a professor with the Department of Renewable Resources and the director of the Western Partnership for Wildland Fire Science at the University of Alberta. He worked as a meteorologist for a few years, then as a physical scientist, research scientist, and senior research scientist with the Canadian Forest Service. And Dr. Flanagan's primary research interests include fire and weather-climate interactions, including the potential impact of climate change, lightning-ignited forest fires, landscape fire modeling, and interactions between vegetation, fire, and weather. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the escalating legal battle between the Governor of North Carolina and the U.S. Attorney General. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now, Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, who's Emeritus Professor of Medicine at the University of North Carolina Center for Infectious Diseases. He was arrested outside of the North Carolina State House while peacefully demonstrating on Moral Monday against laws he saw as hurting children and the poor. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Charles Vanderhorst.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And it does seem that the rhetoric and the law, if you will, or lawsuits are escalating between the Attorney General of the United States and the Governor of North Carolina. Today, Attorney General Loretta Lynch said that the state of North Carolina has engaged in state-sponsored discrimination against transgender individuals. And she went on to say that She had the Justice Department had sent a letter to North Carolina's Governor Pat McCrory warning that this bathroom law that they put in down in North Carolina have violated Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. But quoting the Attorney General, instead of replying, North Carolina and its governor chose to respond by suing. Thus, we are filing civil rights lawsuits against North Carolina. So, you know, at the risk of starting another civil war, what are these people doing down there? You know,
Well, so this law, you know, first of all, it's been known as the bathroom law, which is actually, I think, a misnomer, because this law was passed in 12 hours by both houses of a special session of our legislature. They spent $46,000 for 12 hours, passed by the House and the Senate, and then signed by the governor within 12 hours with no hearings on the matter. And it wasn't just banning any county or city within North Carolina from passing a law allowing transgender people to use bathrooms with their self-identified gender. It also banned any state court, any discrimination suit filed in North Carolina state courts on any issue for, you know, gender, religion, race, transgender people, all lawsuits like that. It also banned any city or county from raising the minimum wage. So this was quite a far-reaching bill for that, and so it's a misnomer to call it the bathroom bill. So that's one thing. And then for the governor to say that, well, he needs more time, et cetera. So they wanted more. They asked the attorney general, the U.S. attorney general, for more time to respond. But they had actually passed this law in 12 hours. They didn't listen to experts. They didn't, you know, poll people or anything like that. So this was a manufactured issue to mobilize the base of the conservative wing of the Republican Party in North Carolina. It had nothing to do with protecting women or children. If it had something to do with protecting women and children, they would have expanded Medicaid. So, you know, mothers get sick in North Carolina, and about 1,500 to 2,000 die every year. That's not very good for their children. They would have fully funded the public school system here and not cut teachers' aides. The teacher salaries in North Carolina are among the lowest in the country. They would have expanded preschool for these children. So they really don't give a damn about women or children. So this has nothing to do with protecting women or children and everything to do with the November election.
So this is basically what happens when Christian fundamentalists take power. I mean, isn't this being driven by Christian fundamentalism and that constituency? I mean, aren't they diverting funds into charter schools and religiously based education while impoverishing public education?
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other very, very bad issue. They've systematically, in the last 6 years since they've taken control of the legislature, they've systematically gutted our public school system by not providing adequate funds for the current students, by getting rid of teachers' aides, and by then allowing these, what I think are really modern-day segregation academies, that were set up in the 60s in the South, as you recall, when there was orders requiring integration. They set up these private segregation academies. This is the modern-day equivalent. There was a report of the charter school system showed that they were almost all segregated, either all black or all white. And that report was suppressed by our Lieutenant Governor, Dan Forrest. I wouldn't say, though, that it's just the religious right. I think what goes on in North Carolina has been going on for 50 years by the Republican Party. And what that is that it's quite cynical. I don't believe that our leadership in the Senate and House of the governor, they're not fundamentalists. What they do is they want to win re-election. And this kind of issue always mobilizes their base and gets them reelected. They're very, very cynical. So they did this the last time, 4 years ago, they did this by having the marriage amendment passed, and that passed in all 99 out of 100 counties, or 98 of 100 counties, or something like that. So, and that, again, they could care less. They knew it wasn't going to stand up in court, as they know that the current law, HB 2, won't hold up to scrutiny in court. But they passed it because they want to get all the religious right riled up, so they'll come out and all these preachers will say, go vote, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the only reason they did it.
Now, of course, the governor himself is being challenged in this election by the Attorney General, who refused to implement these laws, this so-called bathroom law. But as you've pointed out, and frankly, there has not been a lot of coverage of this, this was a series of laws that were passed in a sort of special midnight session that lasted, 12 hours? And one of them was to deny a raise in the minimum wage. So again, though, I'm trying to get an understanding of how, and it does seem to be fall along partisan lines, whether they're cynical. When you say they're cynical, they're not necessarily motivated by religious zeal, but they are motivating their base that is motivated by religious zeal. But how can Christians, for example, you've got a Republican governor in the state of Michigan and his state government that have poisoned children in Flint, and do they care about that? Is that big government interference, or are they just obsessed with bathrooms?
Yeah, well, we have the same issues here. So we have this giant lake here, a man-made lake called Jordan Lake, and Raleigh, Durham, and other cities, major cities, all get their water from there. Over 300,000 people get their water, and it's steadily getting polluted. And rather than dealing with that, there was a requirement that previous legislature had passed a deadline for implementing pollution controls and things like that. When the Republicans took over, they got rid of those. And so I think they're quite cynical. I think they want, this is, you know, Art Pope here and the Koch brothers nationally. They want a non-existent government that's crippled. They don't believe in public education. They don't believe in a universal right to health care. So I think it's incredibly cynical manipulation. And the Flint, Michigan thing, frankly, I've read a lot about that. You know, there's no, and I'm a physician, so I have to deal with this, there's no safe level of lead in the water. And those children were poisoned for 18 months, and it's permanent damage. This is not something that's reversible. So those kids are permanently harmed. And it's not just the governor there, and they're the Michigan Environment Department of Environmental Studies are there. It's also the U.S. Congress. So a city like Flint has a low tax base. It's a poor city. And so they can't afford to replace lead pipes. In the homes, the individuals can't, and the city can't. So it has this decaying infrastructure. We used to have major infrastructure support for our cities and towns, recognizing that some towns needed more help than others. And the original plan was revenue sharing, and that was Richard Nixon passed that, and it was Ronald Reagan who got rid of it. We have seen since the time of Ronald Reagan until the present, we've seen a 75% cut in infrastructure. The Environmental Protection Agency, which has no teeth, but it does have staff to regulate and inspect these issues, they've been cut by millions of dollars by the federal Congress. So they can't do the work. So although Congress will blame them for Flint, they've been steadily bleeding the EPA dry. So I think it's politicians are cynical. They don't believe in government taking care of people, the importance of government doing it, not just protecting us from defense, but protecting us from polluted water, polluted air, making sure that our schools are good, and that we're get a great education. So
So you've got, in North Carolina, essentially got a government for Art Pope. He's the one who put up most of the money to get these Republicans elected, right? And they faithfully executed their office to enrich Art Pope.
Right. That was done in 2010. So he, prior to the 2010 census, so remember the U.S. Constitution says there has to be a census every 10 years, and he, in 2009... He identified 21 House and Senate districts which were held by Democrats, and he felt, but it was sort of 49-51% Democratic Republican, and he felt he could flip them. So he spent $2 million, so about $100,000 per district, and he flipped 19 of the 21 districts. So that both the House and Senate of North Carolina were flipped and became Republican controlled, and then subsequently, 2 years later, the governor went Republican as well. Because it was a new census, they had to redraw the House and Senate districts, both federally and as well as the state districts, and they gerrymandered it. So although there's a majority of Democrats, for instance, on the federal representatives, of our 13 representatives, I believe we only have 2 Democrats and 11 Republicans, even though it's closer to, should be 50-50, but they gerrymandered it so that it remains in Republican control, both at the federal level and at our state level.
But the so-called bathroom law that's at the center of this escalating battle between the Governor Pat McCrory of North Carolina and Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General of the United States, that, to your mind, though, is a part of this whole cynical game that's going on here for McCrory and the Republicans to get reelected by simply just inflaming their base with this idea that somehow you go into a public toilet and as a straight person you come out as a gay person. And the idea that this law was designed in such a way that you essentially have to show ID, show your identification, your birth certificate, for God's sake, to enter a public toilet. I mean, how practical is that? And frankly, as far as I know, in public toilets, there are stalls where people can go in and conduct their business privately. So this whole thing seems to be a manufactured crisis.
Yeah, so it was interesting. I was speaking at the Conference of World Affairs a couple weeks ago in Boulder, Colorado, and I went to go to the loo, and I go outside where we're all meeting, and there's a bathroom, and it's for either men or women, and there's big stalls that go floor to ceiling for everything, for both the toilets and the urinals. So it was perfectly safe, perfectly fine, and no one raised an eyebrow about it. I think, though, the one thing I can say is that, and this is a problem that that we on the left have to recognize, is that we have to explain things and instead of, you know, just saying all these people are stupid, because we're playing into the game of these Republican leaders, okay? So we don't want to do that. What we want to say is deal with facts and say, you know, one, there never, ever has been a single transgender person, attacking a child or a woman. And political fact has looked at that, and there's been none. Two, we already have laws on the book for predators. Three, the stalls can be modified to make them so you have perfect privacy. So things like that, and not just completely dismiss their concerns, because what the politicians should be doing is explaining that, explaining that this is not an issue, and, you know, that the governor should grow a pair of balls and just tell the truth. He knows this is a non-issue, but instead he only wants to get reelected and play to the base.
Well, but there's a broader anxiety amongst the so-called base, isn't there, that the country is not going in the direction that they like, that this sort of atavistic world that Ronald Reagan hearkened to, the Ozzie and Harriet perfect nuclear family, the days when blacks and Latinos were invisible, that somehow we can return to those days and those family values that they always espouse. And that's why, you know, you've got all of this sort of political rebellion going on. People flocking to Donald Trump, to the man on a white horse who's going to roll back the clock and make America great again. I think you have to put this into a broader context, don't you? A kind of culture clash that's going on between a multicultural American future and a kind of reactionary sort of effort at atavistic renewal of white privilege.
Well, I think that is true. I think people are scared and frightened, and our political leaders have simplified what's going on and want to go back to the past. I agree with you 100% on that. The problem is that, you know, there are issues that, and I think that the current presidential election plays that out, both with the left and the right, is that the parties, the main parties, have ignored, they haven't helped the people who need help. There are pockets of the country that have high unemployment and are desperate and are scared and frightened. So the idea of an immigrant coming in and stealing their job is a very urgent thing. You know, we still have people who are starving in the United States who live in these decaying cities or, coal towns and things like that. So they're scared and frightened. And rather than coming up with some way to help them, we just, we play them every 4 years. And then ignore them for the next 3 years. So I think it's a huge problem, and it is, you know, for those who are sort of white males, traditional white males, lower middle class and poor whites. They're scared of transgender people. They don't understand it. They're scared of minorities and Hispanics and Syrians, et cetera, et cetera. They're just terrified of it. And they need jobs. They need health insurance. And they don't understand is that the Republicans have been ignoring them for 4 years, for decades, actually. And so that, on the other hand, you've got on the Bernie Sanders side, you've got these young whites. And they don't understand how complicated things are. And they, Bernie says he's going to have a revolution. But does manage to get out some votes, but he hasn't convinced minorities who don't trust him. It's an interesting and difficult time. I don't know what's going to happen. But meanwhile, here in North Carolina, I think the boycott is essential. I think the attorney general, a boycott of businesses and performers, artists is crucial because that does have an impact. So the average North Carolinian, even evangelical Christians, when they see jobs going away, that registers. And there are quotes in the paper about that and on the radio. And I think, we're going to keep protesting here in North Carolina, the bill, and filing lawsuits against our governor and legislature about voting rights, about transgender rights, etc.
And I think already a number of big corporations have acted. I believe Deutsche Bank, Apple, PayPal, exactly. And you're saying that's resonating. People are starting to wake up that there's a cost to this ideological hysteria that's being used, as you say, to manipulate people to vote for Republicans.
Yeah, there's no question. It takes a slow thing. So people who were going to expand the businesses, they can make a decision right away. A convention, it's hard to cancel a convention when it's 2 weeks from now. But a year from now, they can decide, no, they're not going to have their meeting here. So the NBA All-Star Game, that doesn't have to be here. Michael Jordan is making noises about moving the Hornets. That would have the Charlotte Hornets. That would have a devastating impact on the economy of Charlotte.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Charles Vanderhorst.
It was great talking to you, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, who's an emeritus professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina Center for Infectious Diseases. He was arrested outside of the North Carolina State House while peacefully demonstrating on Moral Monday against laws he saw as hurting children and the poor. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into efforts underway by dissident factions in the Republican establishment to find an alternative candidate to Donald Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Richard Winger, the publisher and editor of Ballot Access News. So, Richard, it's pretty clear to a lot of analysts that the Republican Party is either dividing into factions or just totally cracking up. And I understand a lot of prominent Republicans, and particularly the Evening Standard, the neocon wing of the Republican Party, is searching around frantically for a candidate to run as an independent, in effect, against Donald Trump, who's captured the GOP nomination. What's your understanding of how far along that is? And more importantly, you have written that they could still get a new candidate on the ballots before these ballot deadlines make it all but irrelevant because of all these different state laws. So where do they stand in terms of getting an alternative to Trump, the Republicans? And how many ballots do you think they'll get on?
Well, they are having terrible trouble finding a good candidate, and that's probably going to be fatal. But I'm very glad you asked both halves of your question, and I do want to talk about their chances of getting on the ballot if they could come up with somebody. People generally are not aware that in 1983, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Anderson versus Celebrez that early petition deadlines for independent and minor party presidential candidates are unconstitutional if they're in the spring. They have to be in the summer. So since then, June deadlines in five states have been declared unconstitutionally early. Those were in Nevada, Arizona, Alaska, South Dakota, and Kansas. As a result, we only have four states left with June deadlines, and then we have a bunch in July, but most of them are in August, and then there's a few in September. And then there's Texas all by itself in May, and today's the independent deadline in Texas for president. But irrationally, Texas has a June 23rd deadline for independent candidates for other office, and also a minor party petition isn't due in Texas until May 22nd. So this Texas May 9th independent deadline is very silly and very vulnerable to court challenge.
But when you say it's open to candidates, is it open to presidential candidates? Independence, you said.
It's only today that independent presidential candidates have to turn in a petition in Texas. Mm-hmm. Any independent candidate for any other office in Texas doesn't have to turn in a petition until June 23rd. Mm-hmm. That's just crazy. Texas can't say it has an important state interest in having these petitions come in early May for president when they let independent candidate petitions for all other office come in a month and a half later.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know that there was a lot of speculation prior to Donald Trump essentially becoming the nominee because he's obviously going to get the 1237 number of delegates. But prior to that, there were a lot of talk about the sort of white knight scenario of Paul Ryan riding in on a white horse and taking the election away from Trump at the convention. And then a lot of pundits said, well, that's not very practical because of these ballot deadlines. So that scenario has been somewhat put to rest, although it's pretty clear that Donald Trump and Paul Ryan don't see eye to eye.
Yes, I thought Paul Ryan was interesting today when he said, if Donald Trump doesn't think I should be the chair of the convention, well, just let him say so and I won't do it.
Right. But you don't see the white knight scenario happening at the convention. And if that were theoretically possible, by the Republican convention, would most of the big states except for Texas still be open to a third-party challenge?
Yes, and believe me, Texas is open also. I mean, somebody would sue Texas and they'd win. The second earliest deadline is in North Carolina. That's in June. North Carolina is a pretty populous state, but the big seven populous states other than Texas are all quite a bit later.
Right. Again, I'm speaking... Okay. Sorry. Again,
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have interrupted you. I should say also Illinois has got a late June deadline.
And again, I'm speaking with Richard Winger, who's publisher and editor of Ballot Access News. So the other thing that's stymied, you know, that we obviously have this duopoly between the Democrats and the Republicans, often referred to as Tweedledum and Tweedledee. And third parties have always had a hard time getting traction in this country, and quite often if they do, they end up being spoilers whether they like it or not. And the only way that I understand you can get on the ballot is if you're incredibly rich now, and that's how Perot got on the ballot. Is that still the situation, that if the Republicans or the dissident Republicans who are unhappy with Trump could find a candidate and get them on the ballot, what kind of resources does it require?
They do not need to be really rich. In 2008, Ralph Nader was an independent candidate for president, and he got on the ballot in 45 of the 50 states, and he didn't get going until March 2008. And in 1988, Lenora Falani, the presidential candidate of the New Alliance Party, got on the ballot in all 50 states, and she wasn't rich. And I always ask reporters, have you ever heard of Lenora Falani? And most of them haven't, which is too bad, because in 1988, she got on the ballot in all 50 states. She was the first African-American presidential candidate to be on the general election ballot in all 50 states, and the first woman to be on the ballot in all 50 states. So I don't know if you've heard of her, but...
No, I've actually interviewed her at the time, and one of the things that came up was the very possibility that she was, in fact, running a scam to get the matching funds from the federal government.
Well, that's not fair. Uh-huh. She did qualify for primary season matching funds, but, you know, it wasn't... Well, we could get into that. But she needed that money to help her get on the ballot in all 50 states. And this year, Jill Stein, who will probably be the Green Party nominee, is also qualified for primary season matching funds, and that'll help her to get on the ballot in a lot of states. I think she might end up in 42 or 43 states. Mm-hmm. And then the Libertarians will probably be on the ballot for all 50.
Right. Well, the Libertarians are getting a lot of attention now, aren't they, from Republicans and those alarmed by the fact that Donald Trump is the Republican Party standard bearer. Gary Johnson is certainly getting some attention, is he not?
Yes. In 2012, he was the Libertarian Party nominee, and the New York Times went the entire year and never even mentioned him. He did get on the ballot in 48 states, and he did get 1,270,000 votes. This year, the New York Times has already run two big stories about him with a picture. So you're right, it's quite a different year.
But in terms of the Green Party, for example, it would seem to me that with Donald Trump, the Republican candidate, doesn't that mean that the political left in this country are going to be incredibly alarmed at the possibility of a kind of right-wing populist president who already is insulted most minorities, and I think, you know, the Latinos and African Americans and the women, you can go through the list, the Muslims, are they going to have the luxury of voting for a Jill Stein when there's no way in the world that she's going to be able to stop Donald Trump?
Well, if people will just pay attention to the polls, they will realize in 40 states, just like 2012, just like 2008, just like 2004, just like 2000, 40 states, everybody knows which major party is going to carry that state. I mean, I'm almost understating it. Really, it's more like only 7 or 8 states are ever in doubt. I just saw a map recently in electoralvote.com predicting how each state would go. And it's amazing. It looks just like 2008. I mean, it's crazy in this country how most of the voters really have virtually no say in who gets elected president in the general election, because at least 40 states, maybe 42, are foregone for one or the other two major parties. So if people understand that, they should feel free to vote their conscience.
So is that to say then we have some kind of absurd system where you can basically, most of the country votes almost zombie-like, and then that affords people that are unhappy with this duopoly to go and vote their conscience? That doesn't seem to be a particularly helpful system, because you know you're never going to make it. It's just like gratification without results.
Well, we need so many reforms in this country. I'm very encouraged that Maine voters in November will be voting on whether to use instant runoff voting in state and federal elections. And if that passes, maybe that'll start a trend. If we had instant runoff voting, people could vote their conscience everywhere for their first choice and then be comfortable voting for their favorite major party person second. And then another thing we desperately need is reform of the presidential debate process, where we have the Commission on Presidential Debates keeping everybody out except the Democrat and Republican nominee. If we could just change that, that would be a huge difference. And then third, we really, really need to get rid of the Electoral College, because if nobody gets a majority in the Electoral College, then the U.S. House gets to choose the president. Furthermore, every state's delegation is treated equally. So when the U.S. House picks the president, the one member of the U.S. House from Wyoming has the same vote that all 53 members of the California delegation have. One state, one vote.
Right.
And that's why Bloomberg got out of the race. He virtually started, and then he said, nope, I couldn't win, because of that aspect of the Article 2 of the Constitution, because the Republicans certainly will have a majority of the delegations in the House. Even if there's a Democratic majority in the House, that's not what determines it. It's which party has most state delegations. And the Republicans right now, they have the majority in 33 House delegations. So it's obvious the choice of the Republican members of the U.S. House would become president. We need to fix that.
Right. Well, that's one of the scenarios associated with Paul Ryan, that if he would run as a third party and Trump was, and the Democrat were to run as well, nobody would possibly get a majority in the Electoral College, and that would then go to the House controlled by Ryan. And even if it was a new House voted in November, it wouldn't matter. It'd be the old House that votes. I mean, the whole system is broken. I mean, you know, you could add to that the need for a national primary instead of these staggered primaries. The main scandal is this scandal about registration. No other advanced democracy has all these impediments about getting registered in different states and different deadlines, etc. I mean, right next door in Mexico, you get a national ID card, and nobody questions that. And in most countries, you're automatically registered when you turn 18. So
you're right.
Everything about our system is about making voting difficult, not easy, and making ballot access hard and not easy. And that, I think, that's an inescapable truth.
Well, the root of the problem. The United States and Switzerland are the only two countries in the world where the subunits of the nation write the election laws for the national elections. There was a book published by three Canadian political scientists called Rules of the Game, a very useful reference book. It set out the election laws of every democratic country in the world, except they said, sorry, we had to omit Switzerland and the United States, because those are the only two countries where there is no federal election law. So we would have to put in our book the laws of every Swiss canton and every U.S. state. That's why in some states ex-felons can't vote, and most of them they can. Oh, other problems. We're the only country in the world where the residents of the capital city have no voting representation in Congress.
Well, we know why that is, because the Republicans are blocking it, because it would automatically mean two more Democratic senators and one Democratic House member. Again,
right.
it gets back to partisanship. It's if there's two problems. One is that partisans control the elections apparatus, and two, the states control the elections. And that goes back to the Founding Fathers. That was the first demand of the 13 states to join the Union. I don't know. I mean, don't you think there are some things that can be managed? Like, for example, Bernie Sanders is suggesting not that you need a constitutional amendment to change the voting days to the weekend, like they do in most democracies, so that working people can vote and not risk losing their job or losing pay in order to express their democratic right. The Sanders is saying that we ought to make voting day a national holiday, which wouldn't require a constitutional amendment. There are some fixes, aren't there, even if they're not ideal.
And let me mention, Puerto Rico is by far the largest place in the world where, among the democratic countries, which have no ability to vote for president or for a voting member of the Congress. And it has 4 million people. There's nothing else like it in the world, because all the French overseas territories, you can call them colonies if you want, but they're considered part of France, all the Dutch overseas territories, they are treated just like residents of the home countries, and they participate in the national elections. Now, Great Britain has a few colonies, and they don't get to vote for parliament, but the biggest one is Bermuda. But Puerto Rico, 4 million people, and they have to obey the laws that Congress passes, and they have no voice.
Well, Richard Winger, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Richard Winger, who's the publisher and editor of Ballot Access News. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.